Radio Influence. Podcasting redefined.
Welcome to the May 20th, 2020 edition of the MMA Report Podcast with Daniel Galvan. I am Jason Floyd, and come here on this week's edition of the show. We're going to take a look back at what happened last week in Jacksonville with the two UFC fight night cards. Plus, we're going to continue our countdown of our top 100 current MMA fighters. This week, we're going to count down from 40 through 31. We'll talk about this week being the six-year anniversary of Bellator 120. That was their first event on pay-per-view. We'll also talk about Kevin Randleman going into the Hall of Fame and Eddie Bravo's comments that he made on the Joe Rogan podcast about what happened in the corner of Tony Ferguson at UFC 249. Of course, great way to show your support for this podcast. Leave a rating and review on your favorite podcasting platform. And I do want to know, if you want this podcast on Spotify, shoot me a tweet at Jason_Floyd and let me know. But Daniel, obviously, it feels so long ago that we had Tony Ferguson versus Justin Gaethje, especially since we had two UFC fight cards last week. But, overall, when you look back at those two fight cards, Daniel, a very enjoyable night of fights.
Yeah, I'm at a point where I'm like super excited about just things. Like, I'm very optimistic now, and I probably don't have a good reason to be, but I just feel like I thoroughly enjoyed this past week of three fight events. And again, I've been kind of critical in the lead up to it of the UFC for going ahead, but I tell you what, after the week of fights, I was kind of grateful and thankful for it, because it really gave me something to focus on those 3 days, and it was really a fun experience. And there's still plenty of questions and whatnot, but as we talk today, I tell you what, I'm very positive and uplifted after watching the three UFC cards. So big shout out to all the fighters, all the personnel, everyone that put those events together. It's a very tough time as we all go through it. And I tell you what, it was a fun week. It was absolutely a fun week. The fight cards themselves, I wasn't super stoked about the last two, but they really provided a lot of interesting stories, some very exciting fights, and most of all, what I loved about them was that it showed me that, life doesn't stop at 30. I mean, you could peak in your 40s. We had so many older dudes go out there, perform well, and kind of almost put themselves in shot for titles, man. We had a lot of good performers up there in age who did well this past week.
Man, that Saturday fight card, top to bottom, it delivered right from the opening fight of Rodrigo Nascimento and all the way up to the main event of Alistair Overeem versus Walt Harris. Let me start here. To me, like, if there's one fight you have to go back, if you did not watch these fights on Wednesday and Saturday, to me, the one fight to go back and watch, Miguel Baeza versus Matt Brown.
I'm glad you said that one, because I'll give you a different one, but it would have been sad if we didn't talk about it. And what's crazy is that fight didn't even win fight of the night on that fight card. I believe they gave fight of the night honors to Song Yadong and Marlon Chito Vera, which was a solid fight. But Baeza Matt Brown is the perfect fight to show someone who's just a casual MMA fan, because it's so action packed. It has that second round finish and it's so back and forth. I mean, Brown going with a lot of success early, only for Baeza to end that first round strong, and immediately he smells blood in the water and wins it in round two. I mean, that's textbook Matt Brown in terms of how entertaining his fights are. That's a great pick. That was going to be my pick, but upon reflection, my personal favorite fight of the weekend was the fight on the prelim of that same card, Nate Landwehr versus Darren Elkins. I really loved the total package of Nate Landwehr versus Darren Elkins, from the fact that it was just a bloody massacre to the time in which Landwehr landed an elbow and then shouted out to Dana White with his hands down. And of course, the post-fight interview from Nate Landwehr, this dude is absolutely insane. I mean that like in the most positive way possible. Nick Newell, after the fight, shared a post-fight interview Nate Landwehr did after XFC fight, that he was just a madman. And personally, the fight that I thought was just the most enjoyable. It's kind of hidden on the prelims there. Nate Landwehr versus Darren Elkins, because it was a bloody mess, but it also really made me a major fan of Nate Landwehr's oddities.
So you want to be an Ultimate Fighter. Now, that might have been about the best caption I saw on Instagram on Saturday with the face at Darren Elkins, you know, the damage that ultimately took place on his face. But you talk about like pros and cons of an empty arena. Nate Landwehr took complete advantage of an empty arena, because if there was, you know, a packed house, I don't know if we're talking as much about Nate Landwehr as everyone is talking about him, because he ultimately took advantage of not having any fans and everything he said in the octagon to be magnified.
Yeah, he did. He really made it entertaining. And the UFC's done real well with the empty arena situation. They've certainly done a lot better than professional wrestling, where the fans are a major factor. They did better, I thought, than I was watching the German soccer, the Bundesliga, and playing those soccer games in those cavernous stadiums really drives home the lack of fans. So they didn't do that too well. NASCAR, that was fine, right? You don't necessarily hear the crowd too much in a NASCAR event when the engines are going. I thought that was a good broadcast from what I saw. And the UFC, I would still say, is the king of those broadcasts, because you do get that intimate feeling. And Landwehr was a perfect encapsulation of that. But there are so many other little moments inside the octagon that are so interesting that it really shows you that the UFC is probably, out of all the sports, it's got to be one of the top sports that you really get the most out of there not being fans there. I mean, golf might be the other one. I mean, that was a real intimate deal they did with the golf matchup this past weekend. They had like four guys golfing against each other, and you could hear them talking trash. So the UFC is really good at it between the fighters showboating. You know, I know Kevin Holland, I know there was a lot of expectation that he was going to do a lot of trash talking in his fight against Anthony Hernandez. He just didn't have an opportunity to do so because, you know, he won his fight in less than a minute. But these setting at least allow some under the radar names to kind of make a name for themselves by kind of showboating and whatnot. They just better make sure their showboating doesn't lead to them being knocked unconscious.
You mentioned about Kevin Holland. How about his post-fight interview talking about how he didn't have his cheat code there in Daniel Cormier to worry about the wrestling? Chase Sherman with his great line of, you know, the feeling he has to be back in the UFC. And I think, Daniel, you can relate a little bit to his line of, it's like, you know, you order 10 chicken wings and they bring you 11.
Dude, that is the greatest feeling. There's nothing better than that. And that extends to literally any food. Like, I love me some chicken wings, but even when it's just straight up chicken tenders, some Whataburger fast food chain, every once in a while, they'll leave you an extra chicken tender because the person did a bad job of you know, putting it in your bag, or maybe they did a good job. They're being nice. That's the best feeling ever. And Chase Sherman had a nice opening performance. And then, you know, it was a nice little story because, like, you got to think we're going to see Chase Sherman take on Rodrigo Nascimento, who won, in the opening contest, the following event against Dontel Mayes and called him out. And yeah, overall it was a real optimistic thing, but, you know, honestly, I feel like, man, what really made this week do well was that the main events delivered in two different ways for us. The first main event did a good job of giving us some controversy. We love ourselves some controversy, and we certainly had it, right? We had the debate on the corner should have thrown in the towel. We literally have Anthony Smith giving teeth to the referee, which is the most heebie-jeebie moment of the weekend. And then the second time, we have just a phenomenal main event. It was sad to see Walt Harris lose, but it was an unbelievable come-from-behind win for Alistair Overeem. So for this weekend, the fights on paper, I think the actuality was just so superior than what we expected.
I don't know if you saw the Nascimento quote after this fight card was over, and I was trying to find it, but basically says, if you don't know how jiu-jitsu, you don't know how to do jiu-jitsu, I'm going to make you pay. He used other words, but it was a very interesting quote by Rodrigo Nascimento. You know, looking at that Wednesday card, obviously we'll talk about the main event. You got to look at, you know, Hunter Azure gets off to a great start against Brian Kelleher, and then ultimately Brian Kelleher knocks him out in the second round. Thiago Moses, I wouldn't say he necessarily got dominated, but, you know, very easily Michael Johnson took the first round of that matchup. Thiago Moses only lands one strike in the fight and heel hooks Michael Johnson there at the opening part of the second round. Andre Arlovsky just continues to win. Ricky Simon, a good performance he had against Ray Borg. I talked to Ricky Simon. That is on the MMAReport.com and the MMAReport YouTube channel. You can check out that conversation. You know, one of the things that, you know, he kind of, you know, noted about, you know, what stuck out to him was the boxing of Ray Borg, but also the fact that Ray didn't try to wrestle as much. You mentioned about Drew Dober. Great performance by him against Alexander Hernandez. And poor Paul Felder. Every time this guy calls a fight, a lightweight just calls him out. But that fight does make a lot of sense, even though, you know, Drew Dober talking about how he wants to fight a striker. So if he does get a wrestler in his next fight, that'll be kind of interesting there. You know, Ben Rothwell defeating Ovince St. Preux. I thought Ovince looked, you know, pretty well in that fight. But, you know, obviously, Daniel, it was about that main event and the controversy.
Yeah, man, it was a very controversial fight in such that Jason Herzog, who I will tell you, Jason Herzog is my number one referee. If I was, you know, in control of which referee would I pick to officiate my event, my number one pick would be Herzog. My number two pick would probably be Herb Dean. And Herzog's my number one, largely because he just seems like rarely does he find himself in the middle of controversy. And he kind of did an unbelievable job of issuing a very transparent apology, so transparent that Anthony Smith literally called him out on Twitter. But yeah, when you look at this fight, it's tough that Anthony Smith went out there for that fifth round. The fact that Glover Teixeira beat the teeth out of Anthony Smith was just one of the more gruesome situations that's happened in a while. I mean, to me, obviously, nothing's going to top the Alistair Overeem situation, but that was just a different deal. I mean, the fight was, that was the one strike that put him away. Whereas at this one, it was just, ooh, I had like the hair in the back of my neck standing up. But yeah, Anthony Smith was completely out of it. He did just enough to defend himself. And honestly, to be honest, I feel like my criticism for this main event goes with the corner of Anthony Smith more so than the official, because when I was watching that fight, when it looked as though there was time for Herzog to stop the fight, either the round ended or Smith did enough to intelligently defend himself, kind of. And it did feel like the responsibility may have been on the corner more so than the referee, because it felt more like a totality of the damage that Glover did versus like this dude's completely defenseless receiving unnecessary punishment. Fortunately, Herzog did step in, but for me, the focus is kind of more on the corner of Smith.
Yeah, I mean, and for people who do not see the statement that Jason Herzog put out on his social media's Twitter handle at Jason Herzog MMA, quote, "The sport of MMA is beautiful. It's pure. And an incredible teacher. Some lessons are more harsh than others. I've seen lots of opinions about what should have happened, who was at fault. But let me be clear, there is only one person to blame, me. I am responsible for each fighter I am entrusted to oversee. I will take this experience, make the necessary changes, and get better." I don't know if that was the smartest thing for Jason Herzog to do, to come out and put that statement out there. Very interesting kind of to see how Anthony Smith has reacted to it. You know, look, I've had a chance to talk to Mark Montoya over the years. I've not reached out to him since Wednesday, you know, pretty much just because, you know, I kind of let some time to kind of pass before reaching out to him. But, you know, you now look at the last two fights that I think everyone thinks about of where a corner should have stopped a fight. There's a common denominator. And that common denominator is Mark Montoya. When you think about what we saw with Anthony Smith, and you go back to October of last year against Thomas Gifford, and you know, I want to hear Mark Montoya's side of the story. What were conversations that, say, he and Anthony Smith have had, you know, in the time of them working together? Have they sat there and said, "Hey, I don't want you stopping the fight"? But when the fighter says, "My teeth are falling out," that's hard to hear on television and think, "Hey, maybe we need to stop the fight." But one of the things I've thought of, Daniel, is, you know, when you see a boxing fight where one fighter is dominating the action, usually in between a round, the referee will come up to the fighter and say, "Fighter, you got to show me something." We never see that happen in MMA. Why?
Yeah, we don't see that happen. And I feel like we did see that happen a little bit with the Walt Harris fight with Mergulata during the fight, not in between rounds. But overall, the culture is like, it should be more like that, Jason. It should be like, you have to do a better job of showing the referee something. That communication has got to be there. And it shouldn't be just like the fighter telling the referee before the fight, I'm ready to go out there and die. Don't stop it until I don't have a pulse. Like, shut up. Like the official should officiate every fight. Like, it's the same, with the exception, I believe, that championship level fights maybe should be given a little bit more discretion. Personally, I prefer the type of officiating that lets things go longer. But there does come a point where a line has been crossed, and the ability to communicate to the referee with proper defense that you are still in it is a very gray area in the sport of mixed martial arts. It is much grayer in our sport than boxing, like you allude to. And I think it's really worth doing a better job of coloring in that idea, because it just, again, there are so often where you have guys who are not defending themselves at all. As soon as the referee, you know, jumps, stops the fight, he magically gets on his feet and complains and then accuses him of being an alcoholic, Dominic Cruz. But that wasn't particularly good defense. So to communicate that better would be awesome. It kind of sucks because it takes away from Glover, who had just a nice run very late in his career and a hell of a performance against a former title challenger, Anthony Smith. You know, the focus should be on him, but it's kind of more on the official or on the corner. And the one thing I do understand, and I don't want to like villainize Mark Montoya or any corner who doesn't throw in the towel. I mean, there will be times where I will villainize people. There has been a couple instances in the history of the sport where not throwing in the towel was just malpractice. But it's just such a hard thing for these people to do, because like the culture of being a mixed martial artist leans against the idea of throwing in the towel. It's just polar opposite in terms of the way the brain thinks, in my opinion. On one hand, you push through pain, you push through adversity, your job is to get punched in the face for a living. And so it just never crosses your mind that you need to throw in the towel for yourself. It's just, you go in there ready to die, which is a very dangerous idea. But those two things are opposed to each other, because I think the mental place you need to be in to prepare to be a fighter is just different than having the ability to take a step back and be like, all this fight camp, everything we prepared for, we're throwing in the towel. Because for you, I mean, there's probably that belief that you can, you know, get that victory. Now, that's just me kind of getting into, that's the culture of corners. And I think we'll talk about the Eddie Bravo comments later regarding the Tony Ferguson thing. But one side note about that comment on the Joe Rogan podcast was, you could tell it really truly entered his mind to throw in the towel. He said he thought about it, but it didn't seem like he seriously considered it in that Ferguson-Gaethje fight. And I think that's just a common attitude among cornermen across the sport, because these are some tough MFers.
Look, I mean, the entire corner there of Anthony Smith deserves criticism. And look, I have a lot of respect for Mark Montoya. I have a lot of respect for James Krause, but they have to understand of why they're being criticized. That's why, you know, I look forward to the opportunity to talk to Mark Montoya about it. I look forward to the opportunity to talk to James Krause about it, to get their perspective, you know, get their view of it. But, you know, one of the things of, you know, during the broadcast, Daniel Cormier and Paul Felder, I mean, it was full-on press of just, I mean, they were railing on Mark Montoya and James Krause, which leads me to this thought. If that was an American Kickboxing Academy fighter, or if that was a Rufus Sport fighter, would the criticism by Cormier and Felder been as strong as it was?
No, I don't think so, because it would be so difficult to lay into someone who you go to the gym with. I mean, and that's one of the few negatives of having active fighters, or really former fighters in general. Because, like, I mean, obviously, you know, when DC retires, he's still going to have that affiliation with AKA. But I think it's worth noting that there's going to be a bias that you aren't going to criticize your friends, the guys who you went there. And that's why it's probably pretty important to have a rotating list of commentators, so you can kind of mix and match guys who don't have biases with particular main events. But that's so true. That's a good assertion. And I think, you know, I laid down the framework of like the macho MMA brain that so many corners have. You know, these are some mentally tough people who have great belief in themselves in adversity. So there is that, but obviously it was a bad performance by the corner. And what we're looking at, I think, to move forward is to have a better understanding that it's okay to throw in the towel, that it should be more normalized because you have guys who have 0% chance of winning. That's incorrect. 1% chance of winning, just taking unnecessary punishment that is going to take a long time to recover from when it's just so unnecessary and your fighter is defending himself in a way in which the official can't stop it. So you have to. And so it was a bad job by the corner. It's just a very tough conversation to communicate with people because we have had this conversation for years in this sport and it really hasn't budged. There's a couple gyms where they have done a nice job, I feel like, of throwing in the towel. But for the most part, by and large, I think a lot of gyms would make the same mistake that Mark Montoya and James Krause did this past week.
The unfortunate part about Wednesday's card is, you know, your biggest storyline is about the Anthony Smith side of it and his corner not stopping the fight. But really, the storyline from last Wednesday's fight night card should be about Glover Teixeira. Hey, apologies, Glover. I counted you out, bro. Apologies coming from me. I counted you out on that one. But just an absolute tremendous performance by Glover Teixeira. That should be the main storyline coming out of Wednesday's fight night card, but it's not. And now, you know, Glover Teixeira has quietly put together this nice little winning streak. And when you look at the top of this UFC light heavyweight division, Daniel, we got John Jones, a champion. You got Dom Reyes. We all would love to see that immediate rematch. We'll see whether or not that does happen. But, you know, and then of course you had Jan Blachowicz sitting there. He's trying to get that fight against John. And now Glover has put himself right in that mix.
Yeah, he's kind of like the odd man out without the dance partner. I mean, I look, there's a lot of steam right now on the social media webs about John Jones potentially fighting Francis Ngannou, which, damn, that's a fight. Holy moly, that's a fight. Like, I was super hyped for Reyes-Jones too, for sure, after the first Reyes-Jones fight. But if I'm John Jones, like, I don't want to fight Francis Ngannou because he's literally a transformer. If it was transformer, was a human. But I think the Jones-Ngannou fight does a lot more business than Jones-Reyes too, to be honest with you. I don't know why, but I feel like it would in terms of pay-per-view buys. So that might leave Reyes without a dance partner. But for the most part, I think for Glover, you know, he's not a sexy name in the light heavyweight. He's already challenged for the light heavyweight championship. And really, what's happened is he's put together nice little runs and he's ultimately lost to a top contender. He had a tough loss to Anthony Johnson, a tough loss to Gustafsson, and his most recent loss to Corey Anderson. So for Glover, you know, we kind of know where the upside is, but it's a nice story that he's pieced together 4 wins in a row. And a fight against Jan Blachowicz, I think, makes the most sense for him. Because I feel like for him, he's earned a top contendership fight, but he's going to find himself in a fight where he's a slight dog. Overall, though, his well-rounded nature, his offense, his power looked phenomenal against a fellow solid light heavyweight in Anthony Smith.
Yeah, it was really enjoyable to watch on Wednesday. And then, of course, you know, Saturday's fight card was more enjoyable. I absolutely loved, you know, watching the fights top to bottom. Obviously, one of the main storylines coming out of this card is questionable judges' decisions in the co-main event of Claudia Gadelha and Angela Hill, Dan Ige versus Edson Barboza, and also Song Yanong versus Marlon Vera. You know, one of the things that you saw on social media as all these decisions happened was those Florida judges, which my first thought was, okay, do you know the judges are from Florida? So Claudia Gadelha versus Angela Hill. The judges, Sal D'Amato, Chris Lee, Dave Torelli, a.k.a. not Florida judges because they judge all types of UFC events. Danny Ye versus Edson Barboza, Derek Cleary, Sal D'Amato, Troy Winsipaw. Winsipaw would be a Florida judge, so you can give him that one. And then for Song Yadong, It was Sal D'Amato, Dave Torelli, and Howard Rybak. Rybak would be a Florida judge. So it was, you know, close fights. I would not label any of them robberies, Daniel, in my book. You know, I did, you know, in my, you know, watching the fights live, I scored them for Vera, Barboza, and Hill. In Gadelha and Hill, I mean, clearly, Claudia Gadelha wins the opening round, but I scored the second and third round for Angela Hill. I really have to question the corner and game plan of Claudia Gadelha of why in the second and third round that there was just no, I think maybe there was only one attempt to get the fight to the ground where that was clearly her huge advantage in the fight. Ige Barboza, it comes down to the second round, and I think that that's a fight that when we look at issues with MMA judging, that is something is there is so much more value put on a fighter being able to successfully take his opponent down as opposed to being able to defend that takedown. To me, I scored the second round for Barboza at 29-28. And, you know, Vera and Song Yadong, I thought that the final two rounds, I had it for Chito Vera, but I wouldn't classify any of those of robberies. If you told me I think they're all just close fights, but if you had to say I have to pick one that I would classify close to a robbery, I'd probably go Chito Vera versus Song Yadong.
Yeah, we're in agreement there. Again, no robberies, very close fights. I mean, throughout both fight cards, we had a lot of close fights. Like Borg, Simone, what was a close fight in a lot of those rounds. Morales, Gabriel Benitez was a close fight. But those three judges' decisions we had were very close. On my scorecards, I literally went the opposite way in all three. I thought Angela Hill beat Claudia Gadelha. I thought Dan Ige lost to Edson Barboza, specifically because of what you mentioned. It was really close. Barboza defended the takedown. And after the takedown, man, he had a lot of success going to the body of Dan Ige. And then most importantly, Vera over Yadong. I just thought Vera did more. I thought he won 29-28. But these fights were not robberies, and that's why it's hard to have a big-time thought of like, ooh, the judges. And I'm glad you pointed out that literally only two judges involved in those decisions were quote-unquote Florida judges. So, yeah, I would agree, but I definitely felt bad for... I mean, Edson Barboza would probably be the one I feel the most bad for just because he's been in such a rut in his career. This would have been a very big victory, and he just finds himself with another loss. But then you also got to feel bad for Angela Hill, who went up against just a top flight fighter in her division in Claudia Gadelha, who, you know, Angela Hill had a nice win streak, still was not ranked heading into this fight. And she fought one hell of a performance against a top-tier fighter, and she still ends up with the loss. So I feel bad for her too. But for Angela, more so than Edson, you gotta think her best days are ahead of her. Because even though she lost this fight to Claudia Gadelha, what she really showed is that she's going to hang around in this division for the next few years. She's showcased a real exceptional talent in her loss to Claudia Gadelha that, in fact, I thought she won.
The takedown defense is getting better for Angela Hill, even though, you know, she did get taken down and went to the ground in the opening round. Crazy stat from you know, Richard Mann, who's part of the ESPN MMA crew and the Fight Metric crew, where he tweeted this following the fights on Saturday. Three fighters who scored knockdowns lost at UFC Florida: Edson Barboza, Angela Hill, and Walt Harris. Before this card, fighters who scored at least one knockdown in 2020 were 32-1 on the year, with the only loss coming in a disqualification, which was Michelle Pereira versus Diego Sanchez. Daniel, that's an insane stat.
That's insane that statistic was tripled in one night. God, insane. What an insane main event, man. I thought Walt Harris had Alistair Overeem on Dream Street, right? Like, Alistair Overeem has the reputation of having a weak chin in the first place. He gets put down, and I think it's all she wrote. All she wrote. I literally texted you, like, damn, that's a rough 40th birthday for Alistair Overeem. And as I send it, Overeem survives, and you text me back, and you pick up on the fact that Walt Harris, you know, his condition is in rough shape. That's what you expect with these heavyweights who go for broke early on. When you go full force, full adrenaline, full power, and full volume, oh my gosh, that's a lot of oxygen expended. And Walt was just done, bro. He was just absolutely a sitting duck. He could not do nothing. He was tired, and Overeem took advantage of it. Round two, just went to work and put him away. It was a hell of a main event. It told a great story, and it was a fight in which I thought Overeem was done. And in fact, he was not. Overeem, he has kind of one last ride in this UFC heavyweight division. He's got a really nice presence about him, and I'm looking forward to kind of seeing what he does next, because I'm very nostalgic towards that time in mixed martial arts and in kickboxing with him on top, and I'm very interested to see what goes on with Overeem.
Well, think about this with Alistair Overeem. He's probably 20-ish seconds away from having a four-fight winning streak when you look at that Jair Rozenstruik fight. So, yeah, he's quietly put together this nice little streak. And, you know, and look, everyone was rooting for Walt Harris, you know, to win that fight. Everyone was rooting for him. But, you know, after that flurry, and look, I was pretty surprised that Big Dan did not come in and stop that fight. I think there probably would have been a lot of referees that would have come in and immediately stopped that fight. But it was definitely clear after that flurry that the gas tank was kind of coming down there on Walt Harris. And, you know, this was a big opportunity for Walt Harris to, you know, show, you know, looking for that marquee win. He's got several wins in the UFC, but he had not gotten that marquee win. But Overeem puts himself right in a good position there. And, you know, I'm not, you know, and he mentioned after the fight that he's still on the hunt for the title. I, you know, whether he can realistically get there or not, who knows? But, you know, he's going to find himself once again in a big fight. And, you know, that the photo of him embracing Walt after the fight was over, I mean, that's the type of stuff that, you know, the sportsmanship that you want to see in sports. You know, Walt is going to be back. You know, him and the team there at SBG in Alabama, they're going to look at that and say, okay, we've got to work on, you know, work on the gas tank a little bit if we can't get that fight-ending sequence there in the first round. But I'll say this, as much as Big Dan gave Alistair Overeem the opportunity to stay in the fight, Big Dan gave Walt Harris every opportunity to stay in the fight as well.
Oh, yeah, he did, man. It was a long beatdown because, like, you could tell Overeem wasn't going to unleash everything he had because he literally saw what happened to Walt Harris. And he was being methodical with it. Walt wasn't out. He was just down, and Dan gave him every opportunity to defend himself. I think this was kind of a reflection of, I really strongly believe when we have like high profile fights, like the Dominic Cruz one, I think that impacts referees. I do. And I know these are the most veteran referees that we got. Dan Mergliotta is amazing. All these guys are amazing. They're tried and true veterans. But I really feel like when we have the discussion of like a high profile early stoppage, I do think that affects the next week's events. I really do, because you don't want that trend to happen. And that was the case. So I thought Big Dan did a real good job. You know, for the most part, we've been criticizing officials throughout this past week. Maybe they were all rusty with their time off and away. But I thought Big Dan did a nice job in this heavyweight contest. And for the big ticket, Walt Harris, obviously a really tough performance, but he should be proud that he even got there in the first place. And he performed so well in their first portion. And both him, his camp, his community should kind of be proud for the story they kind of like showed people. It was a beautiful story, even if it ended with him losing to Alistair Overeem.
One fighter I do want to mention that lost on Saturday, but man, I'm really interested to see his next UFC fight, and that would be Irwin Rivera, who steps up on 24 hours notice to take on Chikaze. He goes in there, and I mean, he's a wild man, and you know, fighting up a weight class at 45, he comes in, you know, as a 35-pound champ there in Titan FC. He's a guy that I'm really interested to see what does he look like at 35. Really, really impressed me with how he performed in that fight.
Yeah, he did good, man. And, you know, Chikaze on the other end, the winner, looked pretty dang good too. But shout out to Irwin. I mean, that's a major, major, major fight to take on such short notice. I think the other name I would mention, I guess there's two. Jotko versus Eric Anders wasn't a very good fight, but Eric Anders is so good and so talented, and Jotko was able to convincingly kind of eliminate what he was trying to do. So a shout out to Jocko. He had a solid performance against a real talented fighter in Eric Anders. But the more exciting thing to talk about would be Courtney Casey's win over Mara Romero Borea. where she locked on that arm bar, and within like a second of her locking on that arm, I mean, Mara just screamed like crazy, bro. Like, that was crazy. And it was a nice finish for Courtney Casey. She has not been able to really put together too many finishes in her UFC career. She was able to do that, and her slick arm bar was a really entertaining portion of the prelims.
Yeah, it was, you know, and I think now it's, I mean, all of her submission wins have come in the first round, but overall, a great night of fights and really enjoy it. And, you know, look, I do definitely wish that maybe we had some UFC fights this weekend, but we do not have any UFC fights this weekend. The next show is scheduled to be on May the 30th, going to be headlined by Gilbert Burns versus Tyron Woodley. Locations to be determined. Obviously, Dana White wants it to happen in Las Vegas, but the backup plan is for it to happen in Arizona. So, you know, we'll see what those fight cards end up being, because obviously, and we look a week later, June 6th at UFC 250 pay-per-view. Hope we're going to get some more fights added to that card, because it's right now not exactly a premium card in my book, Daniel. But, you know, over the past couple weeks here on the podcast, we've been counting down the top 100 current MMA fighters. We've made our way this week to counting down 40 through 31, and obviously, Daniel, a lot of notable names. We've got former UFC champions on here. We've got a Bellator champion on this list. You know, so we'll kind of count them down here. 40, Marlon Moraes. 39, Jose Aldo. 38, Joanna Jędrzejczyk. 37, Gegard Mousasi. 36, Yoel Romero. 35, Dustin Poirier. 34, Chan Sung Jung. 33, Peter Yan. 32, Thiago Santos. 31, Dom Reyes. I mentioned about Chan Sung Jung. Spoke to one of his coaches, Eddie Cha, last week, and mentioned that the zombie is, he couldn't tell me who the opponent was, but it's going to be sometime in the summer for Chan Sung Jung. You got to wonder, maybe that's to beat Magomed Sharipov. Maybe it's Brian Ortega as potential opponents. I tell you what, we'd love to see Dom Reyes and Thiago Santos throw down at some point. I think that'd be an interesting fight to watch. Peter Yan, we pretty much believe his next fight will be for the UFC bantamweight title. Dustin Poirier, I think it's kind of how does the 155-pound dominoes fall for him. You know, Yoel Romero, Mike Brown still believes that he can be a champion. Mousasi Lima still seems to be the way Bellator is going to go there. Joanna, do we maybe see that immediate rematch with Weili Zhang? Of course, you know, Aldo, greatest featherweight of all time in my book. And then, of course, Marlon Moraes obviously has contended for a UFC title, has not been able to get it done here. But, you know, we're getting that list where we're talking about fighters that I think if you're going to put a percentage on it, good chance that they're going to have gold wrapped around their waist, you know, at some point in the next couple of years.
Yeah, I'm going to have to update the top 30 pretty soon, because I sent you the top 100 when we first started. But I guarantee you Tony Ferguson's probably too high after the fight against Justin Gaethje. So I got to update that top 30. But fortunately, when we look at 30 through 40, everything kind of still makes some type of sense for sure, man. You know, Gegard Mousasi is one of the higher ranked Bellator fighters on this list. And he's had a, you know, pretty much unblemished record, other than, of course, the loss to Rafael, where he dropped the middleweight strap. And I think to me, the names that stick out in terms of who could be higher, there's only one guy on the list that I would say for sure, and that would be Peter Yan. He, to me, seems like the guy who's most likely to become the bantamweight champion next. He's the guy I would go with in terms of picking who would win a hypothetical bantamweight tournament between the top four guys. And that's a tough top four at 135. But Peter just gets me so excited watching his most recent performances. I mean, Dominic Reyes, Thiago Santos, that could be a fight for a light heavyweight championship one day. Let's say John Jones gives up the title. Those two guys are deserving of it. They had such similar championship opportunities where they basically beat John Jones in a lot of people's opinions, but the judges did not think so. Santos's performance is almost more impressive because he was dealing with so many damn ligaments torn in his leg. So those guys are awesome. Joanna Jędrzejczyk, I mean, she's a staple in the women's division. Her best days are probably behind her, but she kind of revitalized her career with that loss to Zhang Weili with just a hell of a fight. So overall, I mean, we are getting into the elite of the elite of these fighters. But yeah, I definitely have to give you a redone top 30, because there obviously have been some of those top guys who have had some tough performances lately.
I tell you, the Chan Sung Jung, it's going to be interesting to kind of see how this, the top of the 45-pound division plays out in the UFC. Obviously, the UFC is going to do Volkanovski and Holloway, but then it becomes, you know, obviously there's the international aspect with what's going on in our world. So how does that put Zabit? So maybe that means even though Korean Zombie does, you know, train here in the United States, how is that affected? Ortega, obviously Calvin Kattar's looking for a big fight. So it's kind of interesting to kind of see how that 145-pound division is going to play out here over the next. And Dustin Poirier, I mean, look, it's, you know, I think we're all waiting to see how does the dominoes play out at 155.
Yeah, yeah, he's a very, very important part of that, of the dominoes among the elite at lightweight. But yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing Dustin Poirier fight Korean Zombie, as you mentioned. And then, of course, you know, Jose Aldo, don't count him out. His name value nearly put him in the cage for Henry Cejudo. And yeah, overall, man, I mean, I just think if you had to tell me when you look at this 33-40, if I had to watch one guy fight, it would probably be Dustin Poirier, even more so than Korean Zombie. He just is always, always, you know when Dustin fights, it's going to be an absolute banger.
Yeah, yeah, he's going to go out and deliver, and we'll see exactly what's going to happen with him. But Daniel, you know, Facebook memories have a very unique way of making you remember a lot of things. And it was Saturday, Sunday, that Facebook reminded me it is now the 6-year anniversary of Bellator 120, the one of two pay-per-views that Bellator has done. I had not realized it's been 6 years.
Yeah, man. It's crazy that it's been 6 years, because I remember where I was when I watched it. I didn't watch this whole card live. I watched it after I worked a college game, a UTRGV game. I went to a draft house, and Tito Ortiz was fighting Alexander Shlemenko on the TVs for the pay-per-view that they were showing. And that's crazy. That was 6 years ago. I mean, for those that aren't aware, the main card for this was Rampage versus King Mo, Will Brooks versus Michael Chandler, Ortiz versus Alexander Shlemenko were the top three fights. But obviously, Jason, that's pretty dang cool that you were there in the atmosphere. And what's unfortunate about Bellator 120 is that it wasn't supposed to be Brooks and Chandler, right? I mean, how far out was it when it was announced that Eddie Alvarez and Michael Chandler was not taking place because Alvarez had to pull out?
Week before.
Wow. Wow. Did you consider not going after that, Jason? Were you like, nah, that, you know, I'm gonna stay home?
No, that never came in my thought process. You know, I mean, obviously it was, you know, thinking of it from at that time, you knew it was kind of this, it was potentially a big moment for Bellator and kind of how they could go. I mean, you think about it, it was, Bjorn Redmond only had one more event after Bellator 120. And then, you know, he was let go by Viacom. Scott Coker came in. You know, it's kind of, you think about that timeline. We talked about a couple weeks ago, you know, if there's a 30 for 30 MMA, to me, I think that month time frame of everything that happened there. You know, I did a piece yesterday with Sean Wheelock as we kind of reminisced about, you know, our memories of it. I remember the conference call, and, you know, they come to me first on the conference call. I don't know if it was my first or second question. I know that there was apparently some fighters didn't necessarily like my line of questioning, but, you know, I asked Bjorn, I said, hey, is this thing staying on pay-per-view? Which I thought was a legitimate question. And, you know, and Bjorn said, no, they were going to stick on pay-per-view. They went with Rampage and King Mo. You know, it was marketed as being in Memphis, but it was actually in South Haven, Mississippi, which, you know, basically about 15, 20 minute car ride outside, you know, outside of the Memphis airport. Like, you know, and I just remember, you know, for all the Bellator events I've traveled to, it is the only Bellator event that I walked through the airport and I saw Bellator signage.
Yeah, that it really felt like a time when the promotion was going all in on this fight card in a big way. I think with all the advertising dollars spent for Bellator, there was no way they were going to take this off pay-per-view, even if they had to run with King Mo Rampage in that main event slot. I mean, it's crazy to me, like the bigger story, more so than the fact that it was on pay-per-view and the fights we had, is that this is the tail end of the Bjorn Redmond run of Bellator, because I tell you what, when I think of Bellator, the first name I think of is Bjorn Rebney, to be honest with you. To me, he was such a central figure to the early days of Bellator. Like, I won't think of Scott Coker, because when I think of Scott Coker, I think of Strikeforce. And when I think of Bellator nowadays, I feel like it's Strikeforce 2.0. But the original Bellator, it feels like it's Bjorn's baby. I mean, were you able to, like, what was the situation like afterwards? Did you get a sense interviewing Bjorn Rebney after the event that his days were numbered?
No, I never got that sense. I remember because the next event was in Thackerville. And so the week of that event, I was doing an interview with Bjorn. You know, we hooked up on the phone to do I don't know if it was something I put on the podcast or just something I put on the website. And before we started the interview, there was so many rumors out there that Bjorn was on the outs. And I remember I said, Bjorn, I said, hey, man, you know, what's going on, man? You know, and he basically essentially said to me, man, there's no truth to it. And over the years and just talking to people, when him and Tim Donaher were summoned to New York, I want to say it was a Monday morning. It all happened. Is that they had, you know, Bjorn's never said this to me, and I've never spoken to Tim Donaher, but I always got this, you know, that from a sense from other people that Bjorn and Tim had no idea this thing was coming and that Viacom was going to move in another direction. Obviously, it was the best move for Bellator to make. For Bellator to grow, they had to make this move because, you know, I don't know if Bellator under Bjorn Rebney was ever going to recover from the Eddie Alvarez contract situation. For those who don't know what I'm talking about, you know, he had become a free agent. Obviously, Bellator had matching rights. He comes to an agreement with the UFC. Bellator says they match it. And of course, it all becomes a court battle. But I remember after the event, after they did the post-fight press conference, Bjorn said to me, he goes, hey, Jason, what did you think of the event? And I was like, you know what? Overall, good event, Bjorn. But I go, pacing kind of sucked. And he looked at one of the PR people and he goes, can I tell Jason F off? Now he used the full F word. I try not to cuss on this podcast. And he goes, hey Jason, how about you go F yourself? And he said it in a very joking manner, but it was Bjorn's baby. And I think that anytime, and the one thing I always say about the reporter promoter relationship that I have with Bjorn Rebney is I always felt that Bjorn respected me because I would tell him my opinion and that I didn't sugarcoat how I felt about it. So I think that even though he may not have liked what I said at that moment, I'm sure he probably sat there and said, okay, I need to listen to what Jason said and maybe he's on to something.
Yeah, that to me is just the most fruitful dialogue, you know, like it's real easy to be an ass kisser or just kind of toe the company line, but it's not particularly interesting because it's like if you're not interacting with the reality, communicating what you see and whatnot and how you feel and think, I mean, you're just doing public relations for somebody. And if I was somebody who was running a promotion, I would much rather value an authentic point of view from someone rather than someone who's trying to just make sure they get credentialed for the next event. I just find that much more interesting. But there's a lot of people who love being in their own bubble and they love, you know, people drinking their bathwater. So that is pretty interesting. You mentioned to me that there was a fighter who called you a hater after the event. What happened with that, Jason?
So after the event was over, you know, trying to get some one-on-one interviews, and one of the people I wanted to talk to was Will Brooks. And of course, you know, Will had the win against Michael Chandler, very close decision. I don't remember if I scored a draw or I scored it for Michael Chandler, but very close. And, you know, tried to do a post-fight interview with Will Brooks, and basically he didn't want to do it with me, which it sounded like basically he didn't like the fact of on the conference call, which he was on, that I basically said, is this going to remain on pay-per-view? Because I remember after the fact, I asked someone in Bellator, I said, was my line of questioning off base? And they're like, no, it was a very legit question. And, I've always said this, like, as a reporter, Daniel, you can't worry about whether your opinion or questions is going to upset somebody you're covering.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're there to push buttons. I mean, that's why when you look at like 60 Minutes, like Mike Wallace, the great journalist from 60 Minutes, asked so many people so many tough questions who really push their buttons. And that extends to MA journalism. So you're going to have a lot of guys. You're going to have quite a few guys like Will Brooks who may react that way. But for some of them, they'll kind of come to their senses later on, but some of them won't. And that's just the way it goes, man. That's, you know, you're not in this to be people's best friends. It's nice to be friendly, but it's more important to ask proper questions and not be concerned about people's opinions about you asking them in the first place. Cause your goal is just to kind of obtain information for the public. And, that's the case. And, yeah, you were there in Mississippi. I mean, what was it like in the arena? Like, did it feel like a big event? Like, what were the reactions to some of the bigger name fighters we had on those cards?
Oh, it was no question that it was a big event. I remember just, I got there on Wednesday or Thursday. I want to say media day was Thursday. So I think I got there Thursday morning. You show up to the gym and you know, and you're like, okay, this is not your typical Bellator event. You know, typically you roll in the Bellator. If you get, you know, go in there, you know, say 2 days before the weigh-ins, you go to the fighter hotel, you know, Bellator PR lines up, some fighters coming to you. But this was definitely, you got that feel. I remember one memory of media day was Tito is talking to us and Shomenko walks by and Tito is just basically mean mugging Shomenko. And then I remember Shomenko comes up after Tito gets done, he does his media scrum and I'm sitting there going, oh my God, these guys are like two weight classes apart. Like the size difference was amazing. And leading up to that event, I was like, is Tito still this big star? Daniel, when his music hit, like I was like, oh my God, people still love Tito Ortiz, even though you had not seen him in a while. And of course things in the UFC did not end the way he wanted to. It was like, that was like one of my biggest takeaways was like, oh my God, Tito Ortiz drawing power is as big as it's always been.
Yeah. That's awesome. That is awesome. And those guys, man, Tito in particular really understood the idea of showmanship. But yeah, those people who grew up UFC fans following the Tito versus Ken rivalry and the Tito versus Chuck Liddell rivalry, a lot of people when they watched that were very young or were teenagers in their formative years. And so he's just always going to be like that. I mean, when he came down to fight Alberto Del Rio in Hidalgo, when Tito came to the local news station, even though so many people didn't know who he was, he still had that star presence about him. So yeah, I mean, that's crazy that it's been 6 years since Bellator 120, bro. It's unbelievable.
You know, the one thing that, and you know, as you kind of look at what ultimately happened after that event, you know, look, there, you know, Viacom made the right move in what they did, even though there was a lot of people that I knew that kind of when everything went down, I was kind of like, man, you're probably going to be out of a job in 6 months from now. But, you know, Bellator, it was the right decision to help Bellator go to the next level. And clearly, Scott Coker has done that. You know, it's kind of the one thing I'm interested to kind of see with Bellator over the next year or two is how do they grow to another level. Steven Espinoza, of course, that's now who Scott Coker answers to. He did an interview last week where he talked about that once the DAZN and Paramount deals are over, Bellator would be coming over to Showtime, which was one of the things when I saw that article, I was like, okay, people, let's read between the lines. You're not walking away from that DAZN money if DAZN still wants to be in the Bellator business. That to me tells me that DAZN has already told Bellator that once they can get out of the contract, that, you know, they're going to walk away from it. And, you know, it was initially announced as a 5-year deal. The one thing I'd always heard was it was in truly a 3-year deal. The final 2 years were options on DAZN's end of the side of things. And I found a piece Garrett Davies wrote on his personal website that noted it was a 3-year deal in terms of this. So, you know, I'm really interested to kind of see how does Bellator go to another level. We've seen them let Rory McDonald walk away. They don't even offer him a contract, which is very interesting. To me, it's just going to be interesting to see how can Scott Coker, you know, take the promotion to another level, or is what Bellator is currently is just what they're always going to be.
Oh God. To me, it's very difficult and there's not a lot Scott Coker can do to take him to the next level. And like, it could happen, but it's going to be completely unrelated with Scott Coker's ability to promote. He can do a good job of promoting, but to take him to the next level, what it's going to take is pure dumb luck. It's going to take signing a fighter who is a game changer, much like Conor McGregor was for the UFC. The type of fighter that can lift the tide of Bellator, I believe, is what Bellator should look towards. That's my like simple answer to the question of what it would take for Bellator to go to the next level. There's plenty of things Bellator can do to steadily increase their name and just be a, in general, a successful company, which they kind of already are. They absolutely already are. There's a slow and steady approach, but in order to jump up a level, it's going to require the luck of the Irish or whatever nationality this hypothetical superstar fighter is. But these are fighters that come once a generation.
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting to kind of see how Bellator does advance on. But, you know, we were talking about what happened last week and at the UFC. It was announced. The next member of the Hall of Fame was announced. And it's Kevin Randleman. He's going to go into the Pioneer Wing. He'll be the 17th member of the Pioneer Wing era. And for those who don't know what the Pioneer era is, it is categorized as athletes who turned professional before November 17th, 2000, when the unified rules of MMA were adopted and are a minimum age of 35 who have been retired for 1 year or more. Obviously, Kevin Randleman came before my time in covering this sport. I've really been taking in what everyone has said about Kevin Randleman. I was hearing Sean Alshadi tell a story on his podcast about in 1993, when Kevin Randleman was a collegiate wrestler in the NCAA tournament, apparently he breaks his jaw, and he was asking his coach to put his jaw back in place so he could go out and still compete. Apparently the coach wouldn't do it, so Randleman, I guess, apparently did it on his own.
That's an insane story. Kevin Randleman is insane in the best way possible. This dude has been through so much in his throughout his life, you know, and he obviously passed away, which is just tragic. And the part that almost that really got to me with the video was something I had not seen before, which is Mark Coleman during his Hall of Fame speech referencing Kevin Randleman. I actually never saw that speech, and the way he broke up was so hard to watch, but it did a nice job of showing not only how Kevin Randleman was a monster inside the cage, but he was such an unbelievable personality outside the cage. Incredibly tough. He had that you mentioned, which I wasn't even aware of, on his website. He has like a weird like mini biography where he talked about during, you know, early 2000s, he was in a car accident and he had like, he said he had 230 stitches in his head, which does not sound real. So I would not believe that. But he said it was an insane car incident. He had that staph infection when he was fighting in Sengoku. That was like the most ugliest staph infection picture I've ever seen in my life. He just constantly battled back time and again. But in particular, like the highlights of his career are so high, especially in the early portion of his career. I mean, he's attached to the hip of Mark Coleman. Coleman, I think, coached him at Ohio State and brought him along as part of the Hammers. And he succeeded real early in the UFC. Going back and whatnot, you know, at UFC 20, in his second fight in the UFC, is fighting for the vacant UFC heavyweight title against Boss Rudin. And he probably beat Boss. He was dominant early on with top control, but Boss was really good from his back, and Boss Rudin was awarded the decision because of the deal he did off his back. But that's a fight where if this fight happened in 2020 with today's judging criteria, Kevin Randleman would have won the UFC heavyweight title in that fight. Now, he would go on to win the UFC heavyweight title in his very next fight. Boss would give up the title and retire. But again, I mean, the career highlights is winning the UFC heavyweight title over Pete Williams. Obviously, the big performance is the knockout over Mirko Krokop. That's the biggest win of his career. The biggest moment of his career, other than the Krokop, has to be him picking up Fedor Emelianenko and dropping him on his freaking head. One of the most iconic slams ever. Insane. So yeah, Kevin Randle, man, he had so many highs early on in his career, showcased great potential as an athlete, as an unbelievable wrestler, a great spirit, and just a worthy entry into the UFC Hall of Fame. I mean, one of the things I always remember about Kevin Randle, man, it's not a highlight, it's very much a low light, but he was supposed to fight somebody. I think it was Pedro Rizzo, and he slipped preparing for the fight on some pipes, knocked unconscious, and they had to scrap the fight. That was an insane story. So yeah, Kevin Randle, man, had a lot of highlights and a lot of crazy moments in his life.
Long overdue for him to go in the Hall of Fame. And you see that you mentioned about Mark Coleman, what he mentioned him in his Hall of Fame speech. And to see the emotions on Saturday night of Mark Coleman seeing, you know, his friend go into the Hall of Fame. And that's one thing. If you have Fight Pass, you can go in and check out those Kevin Randle fights. But definitely, you know, well-deserved going into the Hall of Fame. And, you know, as I was driving to actually today, we're taping this here on Tuesday. Today was the first day I went to my office like in 2 months. And I was listening to Sean and Chuck Mendenhall talk about Kevin Randleman. And, you know, one of the things maybe said is I need to spend a night where I just go back and watch a bunch of Kevin Randleman fights.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a magical time in the sport because, you know, he had some great moments inside the cage and also inside the Pride ring. And it was just, it was so different the way the sport was. It was very much about star personality. And Kevin had it. He had some great post-fight interviews in Pride that were just awesome. And he, in addition to being a talented fighter, man, he just looked. He had that look, man, like a cool dude, like an action hero, jacked to the gills. And he had a lot of fights and early on before into the UFC. He made his name fighting in these like tournaments in Brazil that Mark Coleman would bring him into, and he won, I think, all but one of those fights. And what he did was he took on a lot of these huge heavyweights and still beat them. And a crazy time. And it's crazy to think that, you know, Kevin Randleman, you know, started fighting in 1996. He started his collegiate wrestling career way earlier than that. And it's just, it's crazy how time flies.
Yeah. I mean, it's, man, I was like the other day, I'm like, oh my God, Memorial Day week is this weekend. It's almost June already. It's just, man, 2020 has not been a great year because of COVID-19, but man, time is flying by. But, you know, Daniel, one of the things that I saw this morning when I was doing, you know, some of my preparations for this podcast was Eddie Bravo's comments on the Joe Rogan podcast, the Fight Command podcast, from Saturday night, as him, Joe, Brian, Brendan Schaub, and Brian Cowell are watching the fights. It's a 13-minute clip. The full clip's actually up on the MMAreport.com that people can check out. You know, one of the things that really sticks out to you is just how brutally honest Eddie was.
He was, and I appreciate the honesty, and it was a great sound clip. Y'all should check it out for sure. And the thing is, he was honest about it in a way where he wasn't afraid to show his ass. It was kind of embarrassing for him and the corner, because it sounded like they were chickens with their heads cut off during this fight. He talked about not wanting to be in the cage, and when they told him to go in the cage for the fifth round, he's like, go for an Imanari roll. Which may have been the best advice, because literally nothing was working for Ferguson at that point. But it was just kind of crazy that at the highest level in this sport, the guy in the corner during that round was Bravo just throwing out like a random suggestion, go for an Imanari roll. And that's crazy to me, but it's real. It's real, man. This was a war. Eddie Bravo is a hell of a grappling coach, and he talked about how when the opponent changed from Khabib to Justin Gaethje, it's kind of time for him to take a back seat and defer to the striking, the Muay Thai coaches with Ferguson, whereas he was more the emotional support. So it was a very raw look on what it was like to be a corner of a huge fight. And I have a lot of respect for Eddie Bravo, and even more so that he wasn't afraid to kind of showcase how chaotic it was to be in Ferguson's corner at that point.
And one of the crazy things that he noted was, he goes, look, the last time that Tony's gone for a takedown was against Gleison Tebow. So he's not exactly, he's looking to have a stand-up fight. And I thought just how open and honest he was about, you know, when the opponent change happened, the fact of, you know, this was going to be a boxing fight, and talking about how it was weird for him. I think the word he uses, you're asking the wide receiver coach to go in the final moments of a game to make all the adjustments. And you could see that it was a tough situation, but you love the honesty for him to sit there and just, you know, open up and give his take on it. And, you know, and I feel like, you know, maybe because of things that have happened with, you know, the Gaethje and Ferguson fight and Anthony Smith and Glover Sharon, maybe this opens up the conversation about throwing in the towel. It's just, it's a culture thing. And I was talking to somebody the other day about this, Daniel, is if you like, let's say you're John Morgan, and just because John's at pretty much a majority of the UFC events, if John ran a poll question for the next five UFC events, asked every fighter on the card, and it's just yes or no, would you want your corner to throw in the towel if you're getting beat up bad? What's the percentage you'll say yes?
Not a small percentage for sure. Because for them, that idea never enters their mind. How could it? How could it when you're doing mixed martial arts? You know, much like Michael Jordan never enters his mind that he will lose a fight. For a fighter, that possibility does not enter the realm of possibility for a lot of these guys. So it's like, no, I'm not even thinking about that, and won't ever get to that point. And I don't want me to think that I'm still in this fight and to have my corner throw in the towel. So I guarantee it'd be a small minority of fighters that would want that to happen.
Final thing I do want to mention here on this week's edition of the podcast. Of course, we appreciate everyone that tunes in each and every week. Of course, a great way to show your support for this podcast is leaving a rating and review on your favorite podcasting platform. Of course, UFC 249, after the event, after his win, Henry Cejudo announced his retirement, which apparently, you know, was not as a big of a surprise to his coaches as to other people. His manager goes on TMZ this week saying that he's expecting Henry Cejudo to return, which, well, I'm probably expecting him to return as well, just because this is combat sports. But then his coach comes out and says, no, man, he's retired. He's done. There seems to be a very big disconnect between what's going on in Team Cejudo right now.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Ali was just giving his opinion, and it's no different than our opinion, right? Like, it's like, well, he's probably going to come back, but it's crazy that his manager has such a different opinion than his coach. But it does make sense in that his coach was there with Cejudo. He's seen Cejudo leave a sport on the drop of a hat, like Olympic wrestling. Mm-hmm. And that's the case. It's just weird that the manager thinks that way when he's supposedly close to the fighter, much like the trainer is. But, you know, that's just, you know, Ollie's not saying anything that we aren't saying. I believe that Cejudo will come back. Although the coach brings up one hell of a point in that Henry Cejudo has shown a track record of just leaving things and not looking back.
And Captain Eric was his wrestling coach in his amateur days. So he has seen what Henry's done here, but I would have to imagine from Ali's side of things, it's got to be, he knows the number that Henry Cejudo wants. The rumor is $2 million. That's what he wants for a fight. If all of a sudden the UFC's willing to give him that number, you have to imagine at that point Henry would fight.
Yeah, like, bro, like, I don't want to fight a bull right now. Like, that's just not something I want to do. I don't want to fight a large bovine animal. But if somebody was going to pay me $100 to fight a bull for 5 minutes with just my fist, like, I would do it, dude. Like, that's a lot of money. And for Cejudo, he's already good at mixed martial arts. Like, I'm not good at fighting bulls. He's really good. One of the best ever. So if he gets the money he's looking for, $2 million, he's going to do it. And so money talks, and that's kind of the big difference between leaving wrestling and leaving MMA, is that the amount of money he can get for one payday from a UFC fight is just so superior than, you know, competing for Henry. So that's the one thing where he may budge if the right price figure is there.
Yeah, I mean, I think the question is the UFC ready and willing to pay a 135-pound fighter $2 million with, because generally speaking, fans aren't necessarily intrigued with, you know, fighters 135 pounds and lower.
Yeah, yeah. And Cejudo's a pretty solid name, but he kind of pales in comparison to some of the bigger draws for the UFC. And for the UFC, it's just going to come down to if they believe the math works, if they believe they're going to get that return on investment. And Henry Cejudo is someone who's very close in terms of making that decision because he's showcased potential. He's made a name for himself in the context of his weight class, but it's a weight class that's historically not done very well on pay-per-view.
Yeah, it, and you know, you speak of that 135 pound division. It's kind of interesting, to kind of see, because you got to imagine now with the with the UFC brass back in Las Vegas, you have to imagine that if it's not happened already, Dana White probably picked up the phone to personally call Henry Cejudo and say, "Hey, man, are you really retired, or is this, or are we negotiating here?" You know, and if not, I would love to see them do a tournament at 135 pounds, but I doubt that's probably something to do. I think they'll probably just do Peter Yan versus Aljamain Sterling for the title. But Daniel, I gotta tell you, man, I'm a little disappointed we have no MMA to watch this weekend.
Yeah, man, I was already hooked. I was like, we're doing this every week, but you know, we're having a week off, and we're all of a sudden we're spoiled with our MMA intake. But I'm looking forward to next week when we can preview a really awesome main event that I'm looking forward to between Tyron Woodley and Gilbert Burns.
Bro, I was watching NASCAR on Sunday.
Yeah, I was too.
That's how bad I'm wanting to watch live sports.
Yeah, I was too, man. I was too. I really hope. I mean, look, basketball is going to be great, and I think that's going to happen. I'm looking forward to hopefully they get baseball, because baseball is going to happen every day and we can kind of sink our teeth and do it and whatnot. But if I'm power ranking, God, I need me some basketball. I know football is going to happen because football people are crazy. You know, I don't know if college football is going to happen, but I know pro football is going to happen, even if they have to do it on the moon.
Yeah, I just miss live sports in general.
Yeah.
I mean,
well, yeah.
the last dance is now over, so I don't have that to take in anymore. Like
the last dance was like a sporting event. It really was. It was unbelievable. It got my adrenaline going watching a damn documentary.
You know who the basketball documentary that I kind of would love to see get made would actually be kind of a continuation of The Last Dance, but it follows Phil Jackson to L.A. and then the whole Shaq, Kobe, and their ability to three-peat.
Oh, that's a good one. That's a good one. It's, you know, yeah. Like, for Phil Jackson, it's kind of funny. He's like, it wasn't Phil's last dance, you jerk. He went and he found a new dance partner and they won some more championships. Everyone else had to retire and whatnot. And damn, that would be great. I mean, the dynamic between Kobe Bryant and Shaquille O'Neal was just such a big one. I mean, for me, I really want to look at some of those teams in like the 80s who had severe drug problems. Like, it was insane how big a deal cocaine was. I believe there was the Jail Blazers was a big team. There's so many different teams during that cocaine era in the NBA that I want a documentary on. That I want an unfiltered look on dudes high during games. That's what I want. That's the unfiltered documentary that I want, Jason.
Like, I was, when the Bulls dynasty ended, I was a sophomore in high school. And it's crazy to sit back and think about that now of you had this great team that they decided to disband because, you know, as great as like the Warriors have been and you look at the Patriots so in the NFL side of things, it is that I don't know if we're ever going to see anything with like what we saw from the Bulls from, you know, 91, 92, 93, and then 96, 97, and 98.
Yeah, I don't think so either, man. I don't think so either. It was an unbelievable story and an unbelievable athlete, and it just feels like in every sport, we don't have too many guys. Like in baseball now, we have a guy who has separated himself for years. Like, Mike Trout has been the best player in baseball for years. He's going to go down and have a real argument to be the best baseball player ever, to be honest. Like, on paper, the numbers. But it's so much different than basketball because like he hasn't won jack in the postseason, whereas Jordan just had a stranglehold. I think it's much more possible for like to me like the most likely athlete to be the next Jordan among current athletes in team sports would be Patrick Mahomes. He would be the only guy in that if he wins a string of Super Bowls, he's done it so early in his career that he's the one guy in active sports I would look at as who has the potential to be the next Jordan, but I don't think we'll see it.
Yeah, I mean, and by the way, if you want to see hilarious meme on social media, on Twitter, you got to follow at Jordan Jamming. So this was, I forget whether it was episode 9 or episode 10, where Jordan's in the back of the bus with headphones on just jamming. Someone has created a Twitter profile of various songs of claiming Jordan was jamming out to. You know, one of the ones that, you know, like one of them was All Star by Smash Mouth. There was a Vanessa Carlton song. Like it is like, if you're looking for a good laugh on social media, you got to go to at Jordan Jamming. Just tremendous.
Oh yeah. I've seen that. That's hilarious. There's so many good ones. They have one with Timothy X-Men theme. And so, yeah, it was awesome. That was an iconic clip in the documentary among so many. And to me, the most interesting thing about it is the one person who wasn't interviewed, which would be LeBron James. And it's so funny because that shows you, in my opinion, how close LeBron is to Jordan's legacy. Jordan is the GOAT. His dominance in the finals, it's too hard for LeBron to pass him. But LeBron's a solid number two for best player ever. And that relationship between LeBron James and Michael Jordan is the question that I want answers to in terms of how those two interact. It is a much different relationship, in my opinion, than the relationship Jordan had with Kobe, almost in a way where Jordan respected Kobe, but he never felt threatened. And I feel like he feels threatened by LeBron James. That's a very interesting idea. So we had no Jordan. I don't think we had Karl Malone in the documentary either, but no Jordan. I mean, no LeBron, excuse me.
How about no Jerry Krause if Jerry Krause was still alive?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, Jerry Krause. Yeah, if we were to pick one person to get a modern interview, like, it's so sad and unfortunate that the person in the documentary who was framed as the villain didn't have an opportunity to speak for himself. That would have been awesome.
But the problem is, after they broke up the Bulls, he made so many bad moves.
Yeah, yeah. Scottie Pippen was really generous in one of the sound bites where he called Jerry Krause the best GM ever. But I'm sure he said that like tongue in cheek. But he did say that. But when you ruin something like the Bulls, you can't be the best GM ever.
To me, he had a very good 6-7 year run as GM. But man, once Jordan left and that whole team left, man, when he said that at the end of the documentary, I was like, man, you know, yeah, during that run, no question with what he was able to build. But if you're going to talk about Jerry Krause, you also got to talk about the post-Jordan life.
Yeah, the one thing I got to say is teams should not be looking to get into a rebuild because it's a lot easier to rebuild than contend for a championship. And, you know, the Bulls found themselves rebuilding for a very long time. And
they're still rebuilding.
At this point, they are. Yeah, obviously, they had that run with the Thibodeau and Rose. But they are in a rough spot. I mean, they literally just hired a new guy to kind of lead the player deal with. I think the guy, they got him from either the Nuggets, I think. But yeah, never rebuild. Especially, never rebuild until you're forced to is what I would go with. Unless it's like obvious that the package you're trading for is going to bear fruit for you.
But just a tremendous documentary. I'm sure everyone listened to us has probably watched, but if you've not, you definitely got to check that out. But that is going to wrap it up for this week's edition of the MMA Report podcast. Of course, you can check out this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, and TuneIn Radio. Of course, always available on RadioInfluence.com. Come up here this week on the MMAReport.com. I will have an interview with Ian Heinisch. He's got a fight coming up. Also going to have Brent Primus. Going to talk to him. He's going to be competing on Submission Underground next week. So we'll have an interview with him. So look for that on the MMAReport.com. So let's go wrap it up for this edition of the MMA Report Podcast, which comes out every Wednesday on RadioInfluence.com.
This is a Real Animals with Captain Mike Anderson Quick Fix on Radio Influence Tampa Bay.
This week on the Real Animals Podcast, I'll be joined by my good friend and great baseball player in general, from here in Tampa, from the University of Tampa, from the U.S. Olympic team, obviously a four-time World Series ring winner with the New York Yankees, Tino Martinez.
I had a great time playing Seattle, first of all. We played there 4 or 5 years, and we actually won the division our last year in Seattle, which was 1995. And we beat the Yankees that year in the playoffs, and we lost to the Indians to go to the World Series. And after that season, I thought, you know, I hit 30 home runs that year, and I hit the ball, you know, really came around and hit about 290. And I thought, man, I'm going to be a Seattle Mariner for life. We're going to have a really good team here. And that was after my fourth year in the big leagues. And then that off season, I got home and, I read the newspaper one day here and I saw, Tino Martinez. And so three different guys on the trading block might get traded from the Mariners. I'm like, man, I'm getting traded. And, Lou Piniella was our manager back then in Seattle and he, lives here in Tampa. So I ran across him one day and I said, Lou, am I getting traded? And he says, yeah, we can't afford to take you to arbitration again. And they want to cut salaries because, Griffey and Ken Griffey Jr. and Jay Buhner and Randy Johnson all have big contracts and they can't afford to give anybody else contracts. And I'm like, oh, man. He said, well, where do you want to go? And the choices were, that wasn't my choice, though, but the people who were interested were the Yankees, the Cubs, and the San Diego Padres. And I said, well, Lou, I'd love to go play for the Yankees. They have a great team, and I love hitting in the Yankee Stadium. And that would have been 96, the first year of a Legend Field, which is called Steinbrenner Field now here in Tampa where the spring training is at. And sure enough, Lou went out and made that happen.
The Real Animals Podcast with Captain Mike Anderson can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Podcasts, and RITampaBay.com.